You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. George Floyd's death last year at the hands of Minneapolis police led to a firestorm of protest across the country and here in Wisconsin. But it was certainly not the first instance of police brutality met with outcry. Ahmaud Jamal Johnson is a poet and professor at UW-Madison. During the recent resurgence of the racial justice movement, he's reflecting on his youth and the acquittal of police officers in the beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles. Johnson grew up in Compton, California. He's the author of three poetry collections, including his most recent, Imperial Liquor, published last year. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about his work, starting with what poetry means to him.
Well, for a long time, I've been interested in history. I think being a student of the past to try and create some context for the things that we experience day to day has always been important. In many ways, poems feel like a reaction to, you know, some mystery, you know, some question, some conversation that I feel like we've been having for generations. So in many ways, a poem feels like one half of an imagined conversation. Like, there are people I want to talk to, parties I'd like to attend, you know, secrets I like to share, and I don't necessarily have those people around me. So the poem seems like an opportunity to engage something that normally I wouldn't be able to address.
Yeah, that's interesting. You told sort of one of our sister radio stations that you're not ready to let go of empathy, and that you're trying to figure out how, like, poetry is a way to try to figure out how to talk to each other and how to talk to strangers, and that it seems like culturally we're missing those things in life. Do you still feel that way about your poetry?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's something unusual happening to us culturally. We're now more connected than we've ever been. Like, our access, like through social media, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Like, we know these really strange and intricate things about each other, but at the same time, we feel profoundly disconnected from each other simultaneously. And yeah, I think, like, I believe that poetry still creates an opportunity to not just engage each other, you know, in terms of like surface level things, but really to think about like how the consciousness works, you know, like how we think and dream and see, and thinking about like the messy and complicated parts of who we are. And those are the things that are not necessarily available on Instagram. Instagram is kind of a, you know, manicured, stripped down, you know, version of humanity. And I think poems offer something that can be raw and complicated. So I do believe that empathy is still possible. And I hope that poetry can be a gateway into, you know, maybe our better selves, or at least like an understanding of our more kind of nuanced selves.
And, you know, there's a lot going on in the world right now for people to process. There's a pandemic, economic instability for many people, months upon months upon months upon months of mass protests for racial justice around the nation and the world. How do you use poetry to sort of center yourself and process the world?
Well, you know, when things are good, people don't pay a lot of attention to poetry. You know, they're busy with their, you know, professional lives, you know, the complications that just kind of like make up everyday life. But when we are in a moment of crisis and uncertainty, people often turn to poetry to look for not necessarily solutions, but some kind of solace, like some foundation. I remember after September 11th, there was this national outcry for poetry, just because people didn't have a vocabulary to explain what was happening to them, you know. And I think with the pandemic and the way we're all experiencing, you know, profound isolation, you know, and uncertainty, poetry really helps to close that gap, at least like helping us to manage our emotional and psychological anxiety.
And you know, like you were talking about looking at history, one way to sort of understand the present time is to process the past. And you're actually from Compton, California. And you did you just leave right after the police beating of Rodney King and the shooting death of Latasha Harlins? Am I correct about that?
I did. So the last year I lived there was in 1992. So kind of the lasting memory of being at home is like watching my neighborhood on fire and, you know, remembering like, you know, canned food drives from our church just because all the grocery stores were gone. It was difficult to get gas. The funny thing about the insurrection connected to the Capitol, January 6th, 1992 in Los Angeles was the last time the Insurrection Act was used. So we had, you know, armored cars on every street corner in my neighborhood. And I would actually have to show my ID to prove that I lived at my house. So when I think about, you know, being a Californian, being from Compton, like that's my last lasting memory. So.
And that leads us into a poem that you brought. It's called LA Police Chief Daryl Gates Dead at 83. And he was the head of the LAPD during the Rodney King era. Would you tell us a little bit about that poem and then go ahead and read it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Police Chief Daryl Gates, he's maybe like the person who's the most responsible for the paramilitary kind of culture that swept police departments across the country. In the mid 80s, there was drug epidemic that swept the country, like obviously like in the late 70s and early 80s, connected to crack cocaine. And it hit Compton pretty hard. And Daryl Gates decided in terms of managing drug busts to develop this thing he called a batteram or battering ram, where there was an armored car with a ram attached to the front of it. And the police department would simply like tear down people's homes to pull out drug offenders. So there was a kind of energy in my community growing up where you never know, like someone can just plow down your house if you were a suspected drug dealer or if they thought you were a drug user. And there was this incredible tension between being afraid of the police and then also being afraid of gang members. So it was difficult to figure out like what community was or who to turn to in terms of protection or defense. So this poem responds to that moment. LA Police Chief Daryl Gates, dead at 83. So the parents blamed the children and the children marched barefoot through the alleys, spray painting their age. And the preacher introduced the word lascivious and accused the congregation of not tithing when the daughter died. And the deacon board smoked. And the economist saluted Reagan. And the police called it an economy of dust. Our meteorologist predicted a low pressure system in the abdomen, and junkies swore perfume rung the air. The grocer had his union. The butcher couldn't outrun his quarter of spoiled blood. The girls wore extra rings and caked their skin with Vaseline, and the men slept the afternoon, growing childishly morose as they dreamed. And I think I thought we'd burn then when the refinery blew and rust began to bleed through the whitewashed fence, when the lawns were done and the schoolyard darkened and the side streets began to split.
And so that sort of addresses a lot of the pain and racism felt by the Black community in South Central LA. Am I right about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at that time, I mean, we're all citizens, right? Like there's shared responsibility, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how do we improve our lives? You know, how do we address and change a difficult situation? And, you know, Compton, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s was definitely, you know, a difficult place to live. And it was this moment when we were all kind of looking at each other, you know, trying to figure out what to do. So there was so much blame, so much anger, so much frustration, which cut across generations, which cut across races. And, you know, when we think about racism in that moment, that was a major piece of it. But then there was also just like a strange, like embedded sadness in terms of like what was happening to the generation emerging in Compton, right? There was so much pride connected to that city. Like my grandparents actually integrated Compton, you know, in the mid 50s. Compton was a mostly white working class community in the 50s. And, you know, by the mid 70s, the city had completely turned over. So, you know, people just didn't recognize and understand their neighbors. And then there was this violence coming from the police department to try and solve a problem that was really a community problem. That was a problem about families. So it exacerbated an issue. So when I think back to Daryl Gates, while yes, there's a lot of anger and frustration connected to the police department, it also represented then what it represents now, like a real failure to address an organic problem. You know, how do we take care of each other? How do we protect and serve each other rather than, you know, blunt, dumb force to kind of like right things that aren't necessarily wrongs? So again, this is kind of a larger, I think, like socioeconomic question. And I engaged it in the only way I know how, which is through poetry.
Well, and you touched upon the sadness that you had talked about, this sort of ingrained, deep malaise. I think in the poem you talked about men sleeping in the afternoon, growing childishly morose as they dreamed. And your collection of poems in Imperial Liquor is also in some senses about that time, right?
It is. If you think about Compton as in the late 60s and early 70s, this moment of a profound political awakening in the Black community. You know, this is coming after the Black Arts Movement, after the assassination of Martin Luther King. And there was all this energy, you know, particularly in the early 70s, trying to figure out what's possible. You had this wave of Black representatives, Black mayors, Black congressional figures like across the country. So here's this moment when people in the Black community begin to really think about, okay, well, let's take charge of our situation and try and figure out how we can create a space where we can feel completely human. Compton was deeply segregated. You know, I didn't have white classmates until I was in graduate school for the most part. So my understanding of a community was very much a closed community. And there was so much pride connected to being from Compton. I didn't think about Long Beach or downtown LA or Hollywood. I had a very fixed identity. And to kind of see all the strange twists and turns, you know, like that happened to people who were real dreamers. Like, you know, we had a fire department, we had a police department, we had our own school district. And to see so many of those things like fall apart and crumble. And a lot of that is institutional racism, but it also was very much connected to the kind of infighting and, you know, like internal emotional struggles that we faced in that community. So thinking about those Black men sleeping in the afternoon, right? You know, they had dreams, there were things that they wanted. And part of my memory of my home is seeing so many people with these huge dreams just kind of waste away. So the sadness is very much connected to that.
And the second poem that you brought to read is kind of along those same lines, mixing like the bittersweet with the beauty with the pain. It's called Smokey. Do you want to give us some context or just read that one?
I'll read it and then maybe I'll say a few things about it when I'm done. Smokey. The most dangerous men in my neighborhood only listen to love songs. To reach those notes, a musicologist once told me a man essentially cuts his own throat. Some nights, even now, I'll hear a falsetto and think I should run.
Wow.
Now this, you know, we think about places like, you know, Compton, the first thing that comes to mind is gangster rap. You know, in the 80s, groups like NWA or DJ Quick, you know, later, you know, Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre, you know, did a lot artistically to represent the city in terms of like contemporary artists. You know, Kendrick Lamar is very important. But when I was a kid, if I thought about, you know, kind of these hard men, you know, these men who were struggling, trying to figure out their purpose, maybe you were afraid of them, you know, but they also kind of loom large in the neighborhood. Well, they listened to Roberta Flack or the Delphonics or Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, these syrupy love songs, you know, high falsetto, you know, harps playing in the background. And, you know, LA, of course, has like a long history of car, a deep developed car culture. And, you know, people would play their music so loud, you could hear it blocks away. And, you know, I remember this feeling, you know, where you would just hear kind of like a thumping melody coming down like the neighborhood, and
the
sometimes
baseline.
Like the bass line, and then like this high falsetto. And so there's a way that sometimes the anxieties that I felt about the community were also connected to this like beautiful music, right? Like imagine like someone doing a drive-by shooting while also like playing a love song. So there's a kind of romance, like wedded to that pain. You know, and we think about, you know, violence not necessarily as an extension of evil, but violence as an extension of heartbreak, right? Like, again, it's just like another, like, narrative of failure, you know, like a kind of collapse of romance. So rather than, you know, kind of dismissing or demonizing those men, I really thought about, like, all the love that was kind of maybe dying or transforming in them, and how listening to those love songs, it's almost as if they were really like kind of holding on to something. Maybe it was like the evidence of like a thing that they couldn't possess. So they still recognized the beauty of those voices. And there was a profound contrast between like the sound in their head versus the action of their hands. Yeah, I think that's one of those things with that poem that I was trying to capture.
And with all this delving into history, into your time in Compton, into even before that with your parents' history in Compton, how does that inform your understanding of today's racial justice movement?
It's interesting because now, you know, I'm processing generational changes. And, you know, like we think we experience things that are new, but we are often experiencing things that are like these waves connected to the past. So there are all these like kind of horrific layers of nostalgia. You know, we get this, the conversations around, you know, Make America Great Again, you know, as a kind of like violent nostalgic narrative. And, you know, the conversations around Black Lives Matter connected to the conversations we had in the late 80s and early 90s around, you know, Black consciousness and thinking about the death of Latasha Harlins or Yusuf Hawkins, the string of murders that took place, you know, in the 80s and 90s that inspired all of those protests then, which are echoes of the violence from, you know, the mid 1960s. We have a lot of gadgets, fashions change, but there's certain things that seem to be hardwired in our culture things that creep up generation after generation. And sometimes I think I was surprised by, not necessarily surprised by the outrage and like the protest, but it was evident that people stopped paying attention to certain things. And then like this narrative emerged, right? Like the number of African-Americans shot and killed by the police, you know, has been fairly consistent, you know, for the last 30 years, right? Like there's not an uptick in this violence at all. It's just the idea that these murders have been captured on video, you know, that we have, you can hear George Floyd begging for his dead mother. So that kind of puts a narrative of grief, of a way that people are not being treated as citizens, into some context. But those murders are consistent, you know, so it's just a question of whether you're paying attention to it or not, or like what's kind of captured on film. When Rodney King, you know, was beaten in 1991, and that was caught on a camcorder, right? Think about technology at the time, not a cell phone, but a camcorder. That year, it wasn't like, oh, well, like how could this happen in America? But it was like, finally someone caught it on tape, and it's impossible for them to deny that this violence is happening. So when those police officers were acquitted, it was evident in the community then where it's like, even if there's video evidence, it doesn't matter. And that caused a riot. You know, so from Trayvon Martin and Tamir Rice to Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, we have video, and the video is shocking, but the video is just a glimpse, you know, into something that has shaped all the frustration, you know, and heartbreak in the Black community, you know, for hundreds of years, right? Like this is just a glimpse into a narrative that is unbroken. So, you know, yes, we should protest. Yes, we should demand change, but this has to happen in a sustained way. Guilt is an unsustainable emotion. So right now, a lot of people feel bad, but, you know, they don't hold on to that. You know, they want kind of easy solutions. And there isn't anything easy about the work of racial equality. So we'll see what happens.
Ahmaud Jamal Johnson, thank you for sharing your poetry, and thank you for coming on Lake Effect.
Oh, well, it was a pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate you shining this light on my work.
Ahmaud Jamal Johnson is a poet and UW-Madison professor of English and the director of the MFA program in creative writing. He spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver.